You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast, which is aired and distributed on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and our topic today is one of great timeliness this week as our nation moves forward with its constitutional and legal processes to install a new president. Throughout nearly all of our history, our country has had a two-party system. So when one of the two parties faces an existential crisis, as the Republican Party is today, it's important to take stock on where the party is headed, what it might mean for our nation, but also, and this is very critical, to find out how we reach this point. My guest today wrote a book on this very topic. He's Jerry Seib, the executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal and author of the paper's Capital Journal column. It's one of my favorite columns, and he's one of my favorite political writers. The book is called We Should Have Seen It Coming, From Reagan to Trump, A Front Row Seat to a Political Revolution. Jerry, very pleased to have you on the show today.
Glad to be with you again.
It's a fascinating period, one I lived through and watched, and all the signs were there. We just maybe didn't see them. But start out with Ronald Reagan for maybe perhaps some of our younger viewers who may not be as familiar. The Republican Party, really, in some key areas, has stood for different things than it does today.
Yeah, that's totally true, and I think this is an important point. And the reason I did the book was to try to figure out how the Republican Party made this strange journey from Ronald Reagan to Donald Trump, and how the conservative movement did. And as you suggested at the outset, you got to kind of know how we got here to know where things might be going. And so that's kind of the purpose of the book to begin with. And in terms of Ronald Reagan, I mean, I kind of came of age with Ronald Reagan. I arrived in Washington as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in 1980, the year that Reagan was elected. And so I sort of felt that I saw a political revolution that year and in the subsequent years, the Reagan Revolution, which was really the phase in modern political history which the conservative movement became, in my opinion at least, the dominant, the most important, and I think the most interesting political movement of our times. It came to dominate not just the Republican Party, but the national political scene in many ways. And it was in part a period that put a close to 40 years of Democratic dominance of the political system. And Ronald Reagan managed to turn the Republican Party into a really conservative party. And what that meant in, you know, Reagan's view of the world was that it was a party that was looked with favor on smaller government, on lower central power in the executive branch, devolving power out to the states. It stood for free markets, free trade. It had an optimistic view about immigration as a force that was good for the economy and for the soul of the country, really. And it stood for an aggressive American internationalist view of the world, that America was, and then in the Cold War period in particular, the preeminent force for good around the world, and it should be a government that was willing to go out and assert itself. And those are all things that the Reagan Revolution stood for, and all of them in the Trump version of the Republican Party are kind of called into question.
There was also Reagan's style, and I remember this whether people agreed or disagreed with him. He had a sunny, optimistic style, which seems to be lacking in both parties today.
Yeah, that's true, and I do think that's important. And, you know, there was a lot of vitriol directed at Ronald Reagan, but he rarely returned it in kind. And it was a more civil time in Washington. You know, famously, Ronald Reagan, the Republican conservative president, and Tip O'Neill, the Democratic liberal speaker of the House, could get together and have a beer together. Or, you know, if not a beer, then at least have, you know, civil conversations. We're now at a point where the Republican president, Donald Trump, and the liberal Democratic speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, literally can't stand to be in the same room with each other. And that's kind of a metaphor for what's happened. I think Reagan's sunny, optimistic view of the world and the views that he held were part of the reason they were so successful and they were widely embraced. And I think that started to decline in terms of the conservative movement in the 1990s. I think Newt Gingrich brought a different hard-edged, combative style that basically said, not only do I disagree with you, you are morally inferior to me because you disagree with me. And that was just never the way Ronald Reagan carried himself.
The first signs of the schism in the Republican Party really kind of were brought forward in the administration of George H.W. Bush in the late 80s and early 90s. It manifested itself in those his re-election. Was it just purely economics, or was it partly cultural?
I think that's when the cultural differences started to emerge, and partly it was economics. You know, the feeling on the right was that George H.W. Bush had betrayed Reaganomics by agreeing to a tax increase during his first and only term. But I think there was also a sense that, well, he's not really a conservative like us in cultural ways, that, you know, George H.W. Bush had a history of being, you know, somewhat pro-life on the abortion question. He wasn't by the end, but he had a kind of a suspect history. He had been to communist China and seemed to like the communist Chinese. He had been an ambassador at the UN and liked that job and the role of the UN. You know, for the Pat Buchanans of the world who started to come to the fore, it was just a cultural gap. Pat Buchanan saw himself as a working class, blue collar guy, and George H.W. Bush, in his estimation, and, you know, in the quotes I had from him in the book, was just a different kind of Republican. He was seen as a representative of the Eastern establishment, the cultural elites, the kind of liberal Republican version of the Republican Party that people like Pat Buchanan, who were becoming much more culturally conservative, just really couldn't stand. And so there was a lot of tension between George H.W. Bush and, for example, you know, the religious right wing of the Republican Party, which had been empowered by Ronald Reagan. And that produced a kind of lack of enthusiasm for his reelection, which is one of the reasons I think he lost the 1992 election to Bill Clinton.
There's still a lot of disagreement among folks I talk to and respect that whether Ross Perot was cost Bush the election or not. I've seen different data that seems pretty believable on both sides. But Perot got 19% of the vote as an independent.
I would add, as a Trump-like independent, you know, a independently wealthy, anti-establishment business person whose main role in the campaign was to complain about the budget deficit at the time, ironically, but more than that, to basically say the establishment of both parties are corrupt, they've lost sight of what's important for America, they failed you, working-class America, and I'm going to fix it. That was a very Trump-like message, coming from a very Trump-like figure in many ways, Ross Perot, and it was a precursor. It's one of the reasons the title of the book is We Should Have Seen It Coming. Ross Perot and Pat Buchanan in those years both told us that there was a populist uprising that was developing. By the way, as a footnote, the people in George H.W. Bush's camp do not think he lost that election to Bill Clinton. They think that he lost it because of Ross Perot, as you suggested. They're very emphatic about that. If Ross Perot hadn't come and siphoned away Bush votes and anti-Clinton votes, the people, Jim Baker in particular, told me that that's the reason George H.W. Bush lost in 1992.
Jerry, these changes that were underfoot going on, and you know, we trace them to this time period. They were among a type of voter, the working class type voter, as the Republican Party was undergoing this change. Was it regional at all? Did it stand out in different parts of the country, states or rural versus urban areas?
I think not so much in those early days. You did see a sorting out beginning, and it was partly along economic lines. The areas of the country that were hit hard by the ripple effects of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, for example, the Carolinas, come to mind. They moved away from the establishment, and I guess in those days, away from the Clinton administration to a certain extent, because the Clinton administration was championing NAFTA. But the sorting out you saw along cultural lines was beginning, and that was less about policy than kind of about attitude. You had, and this is really an important development, you had a whole lot of people who were Reagan Democrats who came in to vote Republican but didn't really become Republicans because they were drawn to Ronald Reagan, to his conservative message, and because he was a departure from liberal Democrats. And what those people decided in the 90s in particular, and up till to this day, is that they just couldn't stand being in the same party with Democrats for cultural reasons. Didn't like the Democrats' position on abortion rights, for example, or didn't like what Democrats had to say about prayer in schools or traditional American values. Didn't like the changing face of America, and immigration was a particular dividing point that started to emerge in the 90s. And these were people who became Republicans for good in the 90s and the early 2000s. And what they discovered, and this is an important turn in the story, is that having arrived at the Republican Party for cultural reasons, they really didn't like the economic policies of the Republican Party either. They saw those as working for the benefit of big business and Wall Street and the banks, but not for working men and women in America. And that was the divide that really started to create a ground on which Donald Trump could operate and get elected president.
One of the interesting things you pointed out was during the administration of Bill Clinton, how Newt Gingrich arose as kind of the face of the Republican Party, the voice of the Republican Party. And a lot of folks feel that this is when the tone of politics changed, not just the different ideological beliefs, which were, as you talk about, undergoing a change, but the tone of politics.
Yeah, and I do think that in the eyes of many conservatives, Newt Gingrich, much more than George H.W. Bush, was a real successor to Ronald Reagan in terms of somebody who could articulate and advocate and successfully push conservative policies. But he did it in a markedly different way tonally than Ronald Reagan did. And that was an important turn. In fact, Rahm Emanuel, who was a Democratic congressman, White House chief of staff for President Obama, who was later mayor of Chicago, he worked with and against Newt Gingrich in multiple capacities. He said to me in the course of doing the book that he thought that the end of the Reagan Revolution really came with the rise of Newt Gingrich as the predominant conservative figure in the country, precisely because that marked such a change in the tone and the outlook of the conservative movement. And that's when, he thinks, the turn toward a more Trump-like way of looking at the world really began. So I think that Newt Gingrich was both the guy who was in charge of the conservative movement when it reached its absolute peak of power in the mid-1990s, but also somebody who found he couldn't sustain it, wasn't Reagan-like in his appeal across a broad spectrum of Americans, and who ultimately produced a turn that was harmful to the movement.
I thought one of the interesting points you made in the book was George W. Bush's reelection campaign, specifically Ohio, as another manifestation of what was going on at the grassroots level and with the cultural changes in the United States.
Yeah, this is an interesting point. Having lived through that campaign, and, you know, sometimes you see things more clearly through the rearview mirror than you do through out the front windshield, but I hadn't thought of the 2000 campaign that way, but Steve Bannon, who was a political guru to President Trump, pointed this out to me. He said, I look at what happened in Ohio in 2000 as a sign that Trump voters were starting to emerge, that the people, and people forget that, you know, the election was very close in 2000, 2004. In that 2004, George W. Bush won re-election because he managed to barely win the state of Ohio, and the advantage of the people who showed up in Ohio to vote for George W. Bush and put him over the top in his re-election bid were really prototypical Trump voters, blue collar, working class voters who maybe one day would have been considered Democrats, but who had become Republicans and who were angry at the kind of the establishment of the Democratic Party. And they showed up to vote for George W. Bush. And those are the people who were going to be there some years down the road in much bigger numbers for Donald Trump.
You're listening to the Heartland Politics podcast on WBIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. My guest today is Jerry Seib, who's the Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal and author of a recent book called We Should Have Seen It Coming, From Reagan to Trump, a Front Row Seat to a Political Revolution. I think looking back to all these things you brought up are certainly totally relevant, but I think the financial crisis of the late 2000s after Barack Obama's election, those two things kind of combined to really turn the heat up on this whole trend that's going on that you discuss.
I think that's right. And this you sort of could see at the time. You know, if you look at the aftermath of the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, you really saw a lot of anger at the establishment broadly writ, establishment of both parties, the financial establishment, the Wall Street establishment. You know, this was a feeling, and you saw it on the right in the Tea Party movement and on the left on the Occupy Wall Street movement, that, hey, the system is rigged, to use a Trump phrase. The powers that be financially and politically are looking out for big interests, for big business and big finance, not looking out for me, and that this is one of the reasons that the Tea Party emerged. It's one of the reasons the Occupy Wall Street movement was so hot. It's one of the reasons you had a populist Bernie Sanders who could take advantage of that on the left, and one of the reasons you could have a populist Donald Trump take advantage of it on the right, that the financial crisis of 2008-2009 had, you know, long reach, I think, and had similar anti-establishment overtones that it produced in both parties, and we lived to see them come in really in full flower in 2016.
The other thing you mentioned, that, again, looking back, and I thought it at the time too, was the selection of Sarah Palin, a small-town mayor in Alaska, who was then elected governor of the state, was selected to be the vice presidential candidate of the Republican Party, and she was incredibly popular. And it just, there you go. I mean, if you didn't see anything else, that was really one of the major red flags, I guess, that something was changing at the ground
level.
Yeah,
I think that's right. And again, one of those things that's clearer in retrospect than maybe it was at the time, but the phenomenal success that Sarah Palin had at the very beginning after she was picked by John McCain to be his running mate, the popularity she enjoyed, the kind of surge of national interest in her candidacy, told you that there was a lot of room for somebody with that kind of working class populist touch. And if Sarah Palin just had so many other flaws and shortcomings that it burned out very quickly, you know, within a matter of weeks, literally. But the initial burst of enthusiasm should have told all of us that there was room and a hunger out there for somebody with that kind of nationalist, populist tone and who reflected a kind of outside of Washington, anti-establishment, with you at the ground level kind of feel. And if she had been a kind of more capable and well-qualified politician, she might have been the person who flowered and turned into what Donald Trump ultimately became.
Of course, that leads us to the election of Donald Trump in 2016, and we all know the differences on policy, on style, but you touched on some similarities to Reagan, which I thought were interesting.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that very much either, because they are so different in terms of their personality. But, you know, they had some basic things in common. Both of them were former Democrats. They're originally Democrats who ultimately became Republicans. They both had, at the heart of their appeal, a kind of an anti-establishment outsider appeal. You know, Ronald Reagan came from California and stormed into Washington as an outsider, and Donald Trump was the New Yorker who stormed into Washington as an outsider. And they both came essentially from the entertainment industry. I mean, Ronald Reagan, obviously, as an actor. Donald Trump, you know, basically as a kind of reality TV star, television actor, if you will. And they brought, because of that experience, a kind of an appreciation and a gift for communicating at the macro level, you know, that they knew how to deliver a message in a televised world, and that was really important to both of them. And it's one of the gifts they brought to the table that I think got Ronald Reagan first appreciation for the ability to communicate in a modern age. He became the great communicator in his own unique way. Donald Trump turned out to be a great communicator as well.
So this book was completed before the 2020 election. Anything you see in the results of the election that are worth, I guess, adding to the continuing story of the transformation of the Republican Party?
Well, you know, it's funny because I was just looking at some of the numbers over the weekend, and you saw, and I think this is a problem for Democrats, one of the things you saw in the results of the election was Donald Trump, even while losing the election, and he did lose the election, by the way, ticked up a little bit in working class counties in the U.S. So the Democrats continue to lose ground in the heart of Trump country, also in religious communities, the evangelical world. And it kind of tells you that the coalition that Trump put together to win is still pretty robust. I mean, where Donald Trump lost ground above all was in the suburbs, and that was in part because of his style, I'm sure, and because of the way they handled the COVID crisis in the White House. But if you look at the results, you see the ongoing appeal of the Trump message in the core areas of Trump world. And that's not going to go away. That's not going to change. You're going to see that part of America, I think, continue to look either to Trump himself or to a Trump-like figure, because he both galvanized and hardened certain attitudes in those places, among other things, anti-immigrant attitudes, anti-free trade attitudes. And in some of the pattern of the voting in 2020, those same sentiments kind of come through the numbers.
The big question is, will Trump voters come out to vote in an election when he isn't on the ballot? We'll see as early as next month in Georgia.
Yeah, I think we will in Georgia, although that one's going to be, there's so many cross currents in those Georgia Senate runoff elections, it's going to be kind of hard to tell. But, you know, one of the painful lessons that Democrats learned between 2008 when Barack Obama won the presidency and 2016 when Hillary Clinton did not win the presidency is that it's very hard to recreate precisely a coalition that is built so much around one individual. I mean, Barack Obama was singular, was first, was unique, and he had a singular, unique coalition that it turned out Hillary Clinton couldn't replicate. She, you know, in some parts she could, but not in the whole, and that was enough to cost her the White House. And I think when somebody tries to recreate the Trump coalition, they'll have similar problems. I think even when Donald Trump tries to recreate the Trump coalition, which he may do in 2024, it won't be so easy anymore. There was something about the lightning in the bottle moment in 2016 that was special. But I will go back to the point I made earlier. Trumpism is not going to go away, even if Trump himself does. It may not take the exact same form, but in its broad outlines, I think it is reflects a sentiment in a big swath of America that is not a passing fad. I think it's for real, and it's going to be that way for a while.
The Republicans are facing, I think, a critical juncture coming up, but the Democrats face challenges as well, and that may be worthy of a book coming up. But, yeah. You know, down ballot, they certainly did not rise to the expectations that were created. What's the top things, I guess the number one or two thing you see that they're going to have to figure out in the future? Because I see problems almost as serious for them as the Republicans.
I certainly agree with that. And one of the disservices that President Trump has done to the Republican Party, one of the favors he's done for the Democratic Party, is kind of mask the fact that down ballot Republicans had quite a good year this year. I mean, they gained seats in the House. They probably will hold on to the Senate. They gained seats in state legislatures around the country. The only state legislative chambers that flipped this year were New Hampshire when they went from Democrat to Republican. So if you take Donald Trump out of the equation, the Republicans had a very good year. And, you know, by implication, Democrats didn't have such a great year down below Joe Biden. I think one of the problems, the foremost problem Democrats have, is sorting out their own identity problem. I mean, as I said before, if you look at the numbers, Joe Biden won the presidency because he won the suburbs, and he ran up his vote totals in the suburbs. In purple America, not in blue America. And progressives want the party to think, and they tell each other, that Joe Biden won because of their energy, which is, you know, undeniable, and their influence and their votes. But the reality in the numbers is that the votes that got Joe Biden the White House came from purple areas in the country, from middle-of-the-road areas, from suburbs that swing back and forth between Democrats and Republicans, and from moderates, not from progressives. So there's going to be a big struggle within the Democratic Party. We're only seeing the outlines of it now as Joe Biden picks his team for the Biden administration. It's going to continue to play out. Progressives thinking that they are the dominant force in the party, and others saying that basically the reason Joe Biden won the primaries and then won the presidency was because he ran as a centrist, not as a left-wing Democrat. And that's going to be an ongoing theme, I predict, in the Biden years, and a kind of a source of constant friction within the Democratic Party.
Can the Democrats achieve a durable majority without doing better among working class voters?
In the short term, I don't think they can. I think in the long run, a lot of Democrats have convinced themselves that the economy is moving past those people and the population is moving toward a new economy and that it doesn't matter anymore. But I think Donald Trump has proven that it does matter still. So I think that's a problem. I think it's a problem also just because, you know, those are traditional Democratic kinds of people that the party shouldn't just dismiss and move beyond. And I also think that one of the other lessons here is that, you know, coalitions don't remain static. I mean, one of the things that happened this year that ought to concern Democrats is that Donald Trump did better among Hispanic voters than most people expected him to, not just in Florida, but in other parts of the country as well. And so Democrats have this idea, for example, that they're just on the verge of turning Texas either purple or even blue. And in large part on the backs of Hispanic voters in that state. But if they don't have the kind of hold on Hispanic votes that they thought they did, well, Texas isn't going to be within their reach. So I think the Democrats have to worry about the shape of their coalition and not take anything for granted.
Final question. We just have about a minute left here. One of the big trends throughout this time has been the nationalization of elections. We started talking earlier about Tip O'Neill, the famous saying, all politics is local. Boy, it isn't anymore. These elections are nationalized right down to the local level. Is there no turning back on this?
Well, it's interesting. I wrote a piece for the Saturday Journal in which I kind of explored that question and said that, you know, while that trend is certainly true, all politics does feel national, not local now. There are some places where people are fed up with the rigor mortis in Washington, with the paralysis and the divisions, and they're starting to turn closer to home, to local, state, even, you know, block by block kind of mechanisms for getting things done. And they're finding that's more rewarding and more effective. And so I think there might actually be a bit of a backlash finally against that nationalization of all issues, because the more controversial issues get nationalized, we've discovered, the harder they are to resolve. And I think a lot of people are coming to the conclusion on the left and on the right that maybe we should just settle in closer to home and try to solve these problems in a more manageable way, closer to home. And we may see that as a bit of a trend in the next few years.
If you're interested in learning more about this period of, and also how did we get here to this point in our politics, this is a great book. It's called We Should Have Seen It Coming, From Reagan to Trump, A Front Row Seat to a Political Revolution. The author's Jerry Seib, who's been our guest today. Jerry, thank you so much for taking the time out to be on Heartland Politics today.
It's really my pleasure. Enjoyed the conversation.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Thank you.